Greetings, all you 99%ers. This is your host, Dr. Jack Rasmus. This is Alternative Visions. Okay, the topic for this week, of course, has to be the Fed rate increase. The central bank of the U.S. has raised interest rates. Those are short-term interest rates, by the way. We'll talk about long-term rates that the Fed has no control over, which are rising for other reasons. And now the short-term rates are simply catching up to them. And what's going to be the consequence of these increases in both short- and long-term rates now on the U.S. economy and globally? Okay, so today, or actually yesterday, the Fed raised rates on Wednesday by 0.25%. This was the third increase since it reversed its policy of keeping interest rates at virtually zero, the Fed federal funds rate, which is a benchmark rate, basically at 0.25%. That occurred in late 2008 in the midst of the crisis, the banking crash, and the Fed kept that rate at 0.25% or less for over 5 years. And it wasn't until the December of 2015 that we got the first 0.25% increase, and then another 0.25% here last December, and another 0.25% now. So it looks like the Fed is stepping up its rate of increase, and we have a total of 0.75%. Still pretty low, but all the projections are we're going to have several more 0.25% at least increases here this year. So rates are rising fairly rapidly now. And what does that mean economically for the U.S. and globally? Well, we'll see. One of my positions is that we saw the rate of decline pretty rapid, almost overnight, of these federal funds rate in 2008-09. They just dropped it down, and then it stayed there for a long time, and it had virtually no effect on the real economy. Real economy meaning boosting real GDP, real jobs, and so forth. And on several occasions over the 5 years, 6 years actually, of near zero rates, the economy actually slipped into stagnation or relapse, we would say here. There were couple times in 2012-14 when GDP for 0.25 collapsed to zero or less. Technically, we could have argued there were at least once a double dip recession that occurred in the U.S. Very, very mild, very moderate, but nonetheless. By the way, you can have recessions. You don't have to have 2 quarters of consecutive GDP negative to qualify as a recession. That's a misunderstanding popularized in the press. 2 consecutive quarters. No, we've had recessions of 1 quarter GDP decline or negative. So it's possible to have a recession with less than 2 consecutive quarters negative GDP. You see, because recessions are determined not by 2 consecutive quarters of GDP, but by whatever the economists at the National Bureau of Economic Research determine is a recession. And they look at not just GDP, but they look at employment trends and industrial production, retail sales, imports. They look at a whole big picture. So these more or less independent economists who gather periodically throughout the year make the determination whether we were in a recession or not in a recession. So actually, we by that determination, I believe we had a double dip recession there at the end of 2012, early 2013, and certainly had a stagnation in the winter of several times in the winter quarter, December, January, February, which seemed to have been a pattern of sorts. The economy got much weaker several times. Okay, so the Fed, the point is that the Fed keeping rates at near zero did not have much of an effect whatsoever on the real economy for a long time. And still is not in terms of stimulating the economy, in my view. That's because economists overrate the effects of interest rate cuts stimulating economies. The Fed does not have that much influence anymore over the direction of economy that is very globalized and driven by forces other than the cost of money. The Fed, of course, lowering interest rates lowers business costs. And neoclassical economics argues that, if you just give business more money and lower their costs, that they will automatically, immediately take that incremental income gain from lowered costs and reinvest it immediately and boost the real economy. Well, that's a lot of nonsense. Lowering business costs does not necessarily automatically lead to reinvestment and therefore stimulate the economy. And that's true not just with the cost of money, lowering business cost of money. That's true with lowering business costs through deregulation and or lowering business costs through tax cuts. Simply putting more money by reducing their costs in the hands of business does not mean they're going to invest it. And we see that so very clearly here in the last 6 or 7 years, right? We've had near zero rates, and real investment has been declining. In fact, almost stagnating here last year. Almost no growth. And that's reflected in turn in productivity numbers that have collapsed. You know, they wonder why there's no productivity. Well, because there's no real investment. So where's that money going of all these business cost cuts? You know, first, the big tax cuts that have been continued, $5 trillion under Obama here, just simply continued the Bush tax cuts, which gave investors and corporations $4 trillion. So Obama simply continued it. So we've had almost $10 trillion in business tax cuts since 2001, $10 trillion. And, of course, Obama's going to cut it even. I mean, Trump is going to cut it, another $6 trillion. And we just saw this proposal with the health care. Ryan Trump Care proposal is going to cut taxes on the wealthy and investors and corporations by another $592 billion. And I'll talk about that as well if we have time at the end of the show. But in case we don't, readers should just go to my blog, jackrasmus.com, where I've estimated the effects of this $592 billion Trump Care tax cut on the rich. Total repealed, all the taxes under Obamacare, ACA, total repealed here in this proposal. And what's the effect that's going to have on U.S. GDP and the economy and prices and so forth? So go to jackrasmus.com just in case we don't get to talk about that at the end of this show. Okay, back to interest rates. Point being here, summary point, that lowering the interest rates to near zero for six-plus years has had no effect on real investment and no effect on economic growth as a consequence of that. And that's because this whole idea of the Fed effect on the economy is really overrated. So why did the Fed do it? I mean, it saw after 6 years that nothing was happening. Why did it just keep continuing near zero rates all that time? Well, because it did pump money into the economy, into the stock markets and bond markets. Right? Trillions went into the stock and bond markets. In other words, banks could come and shadow banks could come to the Fed, borrow money at a quarter or less percent or from each other that borrowed from the banks, right? And then what did they do with that? They were virtually costless money. Mm-hmm. And by the way, if they borrowed it and left it with the Fed would pay them a quarter percent. Wouldn't be that nice, you know? You borrow money and you don't pay anything. You give it back to the bank and they pay you. Well, that's what the whole arrangement has been. So the banks borrow from the Fed, and they then loaned it out to, other companies and invested themselves. And where do they invest it? They invested in financial assets, in the stock market, in the bond markets, in the foreign exchange markets, in derivative markets. That's where the money has gone. You know, the trillions that the Fed pumped into the economy, that's where it's gone. A good part of it. Some of it, you know, loaned to multinationals. They took it offshore and they invested in Brazil and places like that. So some went offshore. The lion's share went into financial assets in the U.S. and around the world, which doesn't, by definition, do anything for GDP. It doesn't boost it at all. And a lot of it just got hoarded, sat on the sideline, trillions of dollars still sitting on the sideline. Now all this talk about the economy, animal spirits and business confidence rising, we see it in the stock market, anticipating that the economy now will finally shake loose some of that trillions on the side, and that will go into infrastructure or some other real investment that now will boost GDP and the economy. That's the assumption, right? That's why we see this further rise in S&P 500 stocks and NASDAQ stocks and Dow stock markets, right? This is all anticipation that we're going to get even more money in the hands of corporations. And that's finally, this time, is going to boost the economy and therefore stock prices and therefore the capital gains. So the whole stock market mini boom here since Trump is reflecting this anticipation, expectation of the future that there's going to be a boost. Well, you know, you can compare the cuts in interest rates and the savings of corporations as a result over the last 7 years. They've saved a pile. Corporate profits have tripled from the low. And bond markets, too. Who knows derivatives, because they don't report that. So, the speculation has produced a lot of profits. And the profits gained from companies producing real goods and services have been because they've been holding down wages. They've been cutting costs. It's profit margins that are really boosting. It's not because they're selling more stuff. No, they're not selling more stuff, making profits that way. And they haven't been able to raise prices that much. So it's not volume of sales or price increases. It's cost-cutting, you know, and the Fed has cut costs a lot, and they've been able to send their money offshore and into financial assets, portfolio and investments, but companies have cut wages as well, up until recently here. So that's where all these big profits, this tripling of profits has come from. It's come from profit margin, operating cost reduction. And the Fed has played ball and helped companies by reducing its cost, helped them speculate, and at the same time, companies have been cutting wages in a number of ways, which we'll talk about. Okay. The Fed has been in the service of the financial companies, financial the banks, the shadow banks, and so forth, for a long time now. Well, that's not new. The Fed has always been in the service of bankers. From its very origin, it's been in the service of bankers. That was the whole idea, to create a kind of, when the Fed was created in 1913, to create an institution which first and foremost would bail them out, which would add to reserves and help banks in trouble. And when the banks step systemically got in trouble, which was every 3 years before 1913, that the Fed, another institution, would bail them out. They wouldn't have to pool their own money. J.P. Morgan wouldn't have to get his buddies together to bail each other out. Now they get the government to bail each other out. And the Fed was run by the banks in the first few years. Not the first few years, until 1933, pretty much run by the bankers. In other words, the Fed, Federal Reserve, has 12 districts, and the 12 districts have a board of governors, just as the National Fed has its board of governors. Well, when it was formed, the board of governors were all bankers in all the districts. So they kind of ran their own policies, right? So it's like a quasi-government institution to create money when necessary to bail them out so they don't have to use their own money to bail themselves out. That's the Fed. By the way, if you're interested in this whole history of the evolution of the Fed, my new book coming out in June called Central Bankers at the End of the Ropes, Monetary Policy in the Coming Depression, subtitle, really talks about the whole history of the evolution of the Fed and central banks, beginning with the attempted creation of the first and second bank of the United States, and then the national banking system from the Civil War on, and then the Fed, and the Fed's screw-ups ever since, the modern period, looking, 80s, 90s, and today, looking not only at the Federal Reserve, but looking at other central banks, European Central Bank, People's Bank of China, Bank of England, and Bank of Japan, and how they performed. How do we measure how well the central banks have performed? Well, against their functions, their defined functions, their targets. Is the target to reduce inflation, or is it to generate economic activity? Their targets, have they achieved their targets and their tools? Open market operations, quantitative easing, discount rates, so forth, So the book looks at those targets, tools, and functions, and assesses historically how they've performed, and, they get a D-minus. Pretty much, in terms of that overall performance. But yet, everyone thinks, oh, the Fed, is so important and so forth. Well, the Fed is there to help the banks. That's the whole purpose of central bank independence, right? So don't interfere with the Fed helping the banks, first and foremost, to bail them out, called lender of last resort function. But then to provide the money supply to them as they need it, and other functions, like performing clearinghouse functions and et cetera, right? Okay, so that's enough for the plug of the book, Central Bankers at the End of Their Ropes. You can go look at some information about it on Google or go to Clarity Press, which is my publisher here, and there's some early information about that. And I'll be talking more about that as we get closer to the publication. It's in final stages right now. Okay, so after that digression, back to the Fed today and the rate increase. Okay, so the Fed function has been to provide cheap money, and that's been going into financial speculation and going into financial asset inflation. Economists say, oh, the Fed hasn't caused inflation, therefore, Paul Krugman's, in other words, therefore the Fed can keep rates low, there's no inflation, so, just keep giving free money to the bankers who loan it to the rest of their buddies, and everyone makes a killing. The Fed has caused inflation, but the inflation has been in financial assets. Well, look at the stock market, tripled. It's tripled from the lows. Well, oh, geez, approaching quadrupling here, right? The Dow was low at about 6,500 there back in 2009, and now it's at 21, and may even go higher. The Fed has really been the same with bond returns, It's kept rates so low that corporations have just kept issuing corporate bonds because it's so cheap. you know, a company like Apple, which has over $200 billion in cash, by the way, 90% of which it keeps offshore so it doesn't have to pay taxes, $200 billion in cash, still is issuing corporate bonds because it's so cheap. Issues the bonds and holds on to the money, or it gives it back to its shareholders in dividends and stock buybacks. And, you know, for 6 years now, we've had $1 trillion a year on average in stock buybacks and dividend payouts, $6 trillion, you know, going to shareholders. Well, no wonder the 1% has gotten filthy rich. Well, their corporations are just, you know, handing it back to them in droves. And, you know, it's because they can issue bonds and because they're tripling their profits and they got all this cash to flush with cash. They just hand it back or reinvest it in financial markets or send it offshore. Right? There's trillions of dollars on the sideline. Trillions. And now some of it's being committed, maybe, because of the shift here with Trump. And the shift is that... The realization is, you know, after six, seven years, the Fed has given them all that they can. The Fed zero rates were starting to cause disruptions in the economy in various ways. So, you know, the consensus among the top corporate policymakers is that, okay, we squeeze this lemon as much as we can. We've got to find another lemon to squeeze. Well, the new lemon is tax cuts. You know, Trump tax cuts. And, you know, Trump infrastructure spending. That's the new lemon. And, okay, Fed, you can, you know, raise your rates a little bit here to make it look good. And just in case we have another recession, you have something you can do by lowering them again. But we got a shift here from subsidizing the 1% in their corporations by means of wage cuts and near zero interest rates, right? Now we're going to subsidize them by letting them take this money off the shelf and use it, stimulate it, and we're gonna cut regulations, which cuts costs and subsidizes them some more. Instead of cutting costs, as they have been with lower interest rates and tax cuts, now the policy is more tax cuts and deregulation to cut costs. You see, it's all cost cutting. Capitalism is not since 2000 has not been normally growing. And, you know, the whole picture is one of subsidization of capitalism. And that's what's going on big time by reducing their costs and fattening their profits as a result and allowing them to financialize and speculate in financial asset markets. You know, so it's cost cutting and financial speculation that's driving the system. It's not, as before, a real growth and real assets and real investment that raises jobs and wages. That's why the job creation situation is so dire. And you know, all they can create are part-time temp jobs, contingent jobs. We'll talk about that. You know, wages are virtually stagnant, not growing, particularly if you're median income, working class. And that's the characteristic of 21st century global capitalism. It's not really growing the way it used to in real terms. So to protect its capitalists, what it's doing is keeping costs down or reducing costs in various ways. As I said in the previous period here before Trump, it was cutting wages in various ways, and it's lower interest rates, and it was tax cuts, $10 trillion in tax cuts and lower interest rates. Well, that subsidizes them. Policies the state is subsidizing corporations in business. All right, so now they squeeze that lemon as much as they can, so they're going to get another lemon here and squeeze it, you know. Well, they're going to continue squeezing the tax cut lemon, but instead of the interest rate lemon, you know, it's now the deregulation lemon and other ways of, you know, fiscal stimulus here, finally turning to some fiscal stimulus. We'll all talk about this infrastructure spending as fiscal stimulus. It's really going to be more tax cuts and public-private boondoggle deals. Okay. So that's, you know, that's looking at this from a big picture perspective. What's going on here with this shift, right? Again, the shift is we squeeze the lemon on the Fed rate cuts as much as we can is causing disruptions. Okay, so now we got to shift the policy mix. And that's what Trump is doing. He's shifting the policy mix. Right? It's not just Trump, you know, corporations. This is what they want from him. And that's why they're still supporting him, as crazy as he is. Right? They want him to deliver on these tax cuts. After that, they'll impeach him, maybe, right? But right now, you know, the whole ruling class, capitalist ruling class policy is, all right, we'll put up with this guy on his crazy immigration and all that kind of stuff, but we'll keep him in check. We'll use the courts to keep him in check so he doesn't go, you know, drive off the side of the road on that one. We got to get him back on the road here on supporting NATO and dealing with Russia. And at the same time, dealing with China, right? We got to get him back on the road because he's driving a little erratically on that one. You know, we got to get him to give us a little fiscal stimulus here. You know, if you look at Trump, I think he's being ring-fenced. Ring-fenced meaning, okay, we're going to control him. Let him do his tweeting and rants and everything. We'll ignore that, and we're really going to have his cabinet and other forces make the decisions, run the show here, right? They're going to encircle him and, you know, let him play in his playpen, and they're going to really run the show through the cabinet and other indirect means here. And if he doesn't play ball, we're going to show everybody, you know, that he's got all these illegal conflicts of interest and he's cheating on his taxes and all that. Okay. All right. So, you know, that's what they're doing, especially running the government through the Treasury and state. You know, those two powerful departments, cabinets. It wouldn't be the first time that the cabinet runs the government. You know, what do you think happened with Gerald Ford when he took over from Richard Nixon, or when Richard Nixon was being, you know, possibly impeached for 2 years? Well, his staff, his cabinet was running the government pretty much. And the same thing in the second term of Reagan when he was becoming senile with Alzheimer's. It was his cabinet that was running the government. So, you know, they're going to do that with this guy. He's going to play at being president, and they're going to control him. They're going to run the show behind the scenes. And you can see already he's being tamed. As soon as he got elected, I wrote a piece, by the way, Taming Trump, and predicting a lot of this. Go back to my blog, jackrasmus.com, in November, and I suggest you read that piece because it's happening. Okay. Okay, back to the Fed here. Another digression on Trump. It's hard not to go back on Trump here. Developments are so interesting. By the way, we may see conflict between the Fed rate increases if they come too fast and Trump, because while I said several times that lowering interest rates does not stimulate the real economy, I do believe that raising rates too much, too fast, does have the opposite effect. It does affect the real economy in a negative way. Oh, how can that be? How can it not affect the economy for lower rates, but it can affect the economy? The economy is sensitive if you raise rates. How can that be? Well, that has to do with the level of debt that exists. You know, we're lowering rates when you have a heavy debt load and a globalized economy and a financialized economy does not have much effect on real investment, real asset investment, you know, buildings and construction and equipment growth and so forth. What we call, you know, new capital investment. And that's why we're seeing this thrust to infrastructure spending, because it's not not generating recovery very much in the housing sector, just at the high end, and it's not generating recovery and making things. So infrastructure is designed, the whole move to that policy is designed to try to stimulate that. Right. It's the whole infrastructure thing is a recognition that lowering interest rates does not have that much of a positive effect on real market development. Okay, that's the broad picture. It will have an effect if they raise rates too fast. Right. If we get another two or three rate increases here throughout the year, that can have an effect on the real economy. And again, I'm not going to go into details of the connections and the mechanisms here, but it's because of the large amount of debt existing in the economy, both corporate and household, and now government debt will go up as well under Trump. It's this debt overhang that has this apparent incongruous effect. You know, you lower interest rates, it doesn't stimulate the real economy, but if you raise interest rates too fast, it does trip up the economy. We'll see. We'll see. If the Fed goes slow on these interest rate hikes, it's an indication that they're not trying to put pressure on Trump. They don't want Trump to be too aggressive on fiscal policy, so they're going to watch and see what his proposals are. But they're going to let him play a little bit with fiscal policy here, with infrastructure, as long as it's not too aggressive. Now, if the Fed does raise rates exceptionally fast, that's going to be a signal that the Fed is being used to undermine Trump. Right? You could have a political conflict there between the executive and the Federal Reserve, which is supposed to be independent, but as I said, independent from whom? Right? Independent from politicians, but not independent from the banks themselves. The banks run the Fed indirectly today. They don't do it directly, but indirectly. All right. So let's go on and keep talking about the Fed rate increase trend that's begun to emerge here. Right? The Fed raises short-term rates. Short-term. Basically, they're called the federal funds rate. Influences that. That's the rate that banks loan to each other in the Fed by pumping money into the economy or taking it out influences that federal funds rate, and that drives all the other short-term rates. Right? It used to be argued that the short-term rates drive the long-term rates, long-term meaning mortgage rates and 10 and 30-year treasury bond rates and so forth, corporate bond rates. Those are called long-term rates, and they're usually bonds. But that relationship hasn't existed, short-term, long-term, or at least it's certainly getting weaker. They don't necessarily move in the same direction, short-term driving up long-term. But what we've been seeing is already long-term rates rising, even before the Fed began raising short-term rates. So it's really long-term rates driving these short-term rates up in part. These bond rates have been rising. We've got a 30-year treasury rate now well over 3%, and the 10-year treasury bond rate moving up to 3%, close to now rising significantly. And that's really the benchmark bond rate, the 10-year treasury. So long-term rates are rising, whether or not the Fed raises short-term rates or not. Okay, to some extent, raising short-term rates gives the opportunity for long-term rates to rise a little faster, which is what's happening. But the short-term rates aren't driving the long-term rates. And haven't for quite some time. If anything, you could argue that the long-term rates rising is forcing the Fed to raise short-term rates. Okay, these long-term rates are going to continue to rise independent of the Fed. Again, the Fed only can directly influence short-term rates. it can't and does not influence long-term rates. Plus, in this globalized economy we have, U.S. interest rates don't play as much of a part anymore. You know, if I'm a multinational corporation, I don't care if the Fed raises rates short-term in the U.S. I just go to some other market, money market in the world, and borrow dollars there if I want dollars. You know, I'll go to Singapore or wherever, right? I can get dollars anywhere because I'm global. And the dollar market is global. So, you know, the Fed raising interest rates may affect companies and consumers who can't go and buy alternatively elsewhere in the world, money. To that extent, its influence has declined as well because it's global. And lots of interest rates, lots of money markets, therefore it has less effect than it ever did before. You know, Fed effect on rates is also because the Fed does not control the demand for money, just the supply of money, and only for those companies that are stuck in the U.S. You know, they don't deal globally. So the globalization has reduced Fed control of rates, even short-term rates. And financialization has reduced Fed rates. In other words, money can be raised through equity, raising stocks or bonds and so forth, right? You don't go and borrow money necessarily, corporations. You know, borrowing loans, business loans, is mostly for small, medium companies. It's not for the big companies. They don't go borrow from the Fed, or from banks, rather. You know, they don't do that. They got all this cash, you know, from raising equity and raising debt through corporate bonds and so forth if they need money for investment or whatever. So the financialization and the globalization has reduced Fed influence even over short-term rates. You know, and that's just over the supply side of short-term rates. It has no influence whatsoever on the demand side, demand for money. And, of course, interest rates are just the price of money, so they are a function of both demand and supply. So we got this picture of the Fed, no control over money demand, and less control even over money supply because of globalization and financialization, and only short-term, and declining influence over the short-term. And now we have on top of that long-term rates, which has no influence over virtually at all. What's driving the rise in long-term rates? And what's going to continue to drive it? Well, global economic forces are driving the rates, long-term rates. And we're going to see long-term rates continue to rise, in other words, bond rates. In addition to this move by the Fed, that will, justify or allow long-term rates to rise. Why? Why will long-term rates rise? Well, because China and Japan now are selling treasuries. In other words, they're dumping a supply of treasuries onto the market, which reduces the price of U.S. Treasury bonds. If the price declines for a bond, the rates, or yields as they call them, rise. So the price of whatever drives the price of bonds down raises the interest rates, long-term rates on long-term bonds. And by dumping dollars onto the market, which China and Japan have been doing, you know, they each have over $1 trillion in dollars in their reserves, currency reserves, and they're selling them because they expect the price of them to fall. Well, by selling them, they are adding to the pressure to reduce the price on these bonds, which raises the rates. So it becomes this kind of a circular fulfillment here. And this is going to continue. China and Japan are going to continue, and the petro countries and so forth. They're all dumping bonds, U.S. Treasury bonds here. And that's one of the several long-term trends boosting Fed interest rates. Another one is oil prices. Oil price deflation, right, moves inversely to the dollar. And if the dollar goes up, rates go up. Oil prices go down, right? Dollar goes up, rates go up. Why? Well, that's because oil is a commodity, a security. Oil futures, right? And the buying and selling influences the dollar and influences long-term rates in turn. I had predicted here last year that this temporary rise in oil prices was going to be just that, temporary, and that we would see another weakening of oil prices in 2017. Well, guess what's happening? Yes, it's happening. Go back and read my pieces. Go to jackrasmus.com on oil price deflation. And also in my book, Systemic Fragility in the Global Economy, I talk about this relationship to some extent. You can read reviews of that on my website. You get there by just clicking on an icon on my blog, take you to our website, and you can read reviews of that book published last year as well. Systemic Fragility in the Global Economy. A little bit of a theoretical slog, but nonetheless, the first third of it is a sort of review of what's happening in the global economy, and I, in that process, talked about the deflation in oil prices in 2015, which was going to abate a little bit, but then recover and recur. And it's recurring, you know, so that is putting pressure on long-term rate in U.S. interest rate increases. So China and Japan dumping treasuries, oil price deflation, right, doing it, and they're going to continue. Both of those trends are going to continue, right? And the global trade slowdown, global economy, which some say is now reversing, I'm not convinced yet, also puts pressure on it. All right. Again, go back to my predictions here on my show, Alternative Visions. Predictions I made at the end of this year, the December 30th show, where I talked about economic predictions. You can go to Alternative Visions at podbean.com or go here to the Progressive Radio Network and scroll down to a couple months ago and my predictions about the oil prices and all this other stuff. Okay. So long-term rates are going to continue to rise. Whether or not the Fed raises short-term rates, and you could argue that it's that differential between short and long-term that's really driving the Fed here to raise rates. It can't allow the real global forces to get in front of it too far. It has to follow with short-term rates, but the short-term rates rate increases will not affect the real economy that much. It didn't affect it in the downturn, but in the upturn, it may discourage some investment, particularly in housing and construction, which is very sensitive to interest rates. You may see a slowdown there as a result. Well, you know, this big housing recovery hasn't been that great anyway. It's been mostly high-end housing, as we get a lot of rich foreigners coming into certain markets on the West and East Coast buying properties, especially Asians. And, you know, that's been driving the high-end price increases. In many parts of the country, prices have not recovered that much in the housing sector. And we're still only getting a third to 40% of the recovery of housing construction compared to before the crash. Right? It's mostly high-end and apartments because a lot of people, 14 million, got foreclosed, lost their homes, and have to live somewhere. So now they're boosting apartments. So whatever construction we have going is, apartment construction and high-end housing. Commercial property is already flattened out construction. And that's probably why also Mr. Commercial Property, a real estate mogul here, Donald Trump, is focusing on that. That's where you'll see a lot of this infrastructure, so-called. Right? Okay, so, the Fed says, Janet Yellen has been saying, well, we can raise rates now because we've achieved our targets, right? Central banks have targets, the first of which is always, quote, price stability. And that price stability is really 2%. 2% increase in real goods and services. In other words, GDP-related real goods and services. That's the target, you see. The Fed will engage in pumping money into the economy or pulling it out to ensure they get a 2% increase. Not financial asset prices, which have gone up triple digits, right? But 2% for the real economy, right? The GDP, 2%. And now the Fed says, okay, we've just about reached that target here. You know, the latest data shows 2.7% inflation rate here. Core inflation has been 2%, though, for more than 3 years. Why is the Fed raising rates now? You know, it's been 3 years at 2%. If you say that's your target and you've been there, you know, why didn't you do it 3 years ago? Right? Okay, so, you know, this thing about targets is really phony stuff, right? Right. And most of this 2.7% here, 2% average, is because we had last year this increase in oil prices, a 30% increase in oil prices. And it's been because we've had some increase in housing, apartment prices and high-end home prices in select markets. Also, we've had an increase in medical cost inflation, mostly because of insurance premiums going up, right? And we've had a cost of imports, you know? So if you look at why we've got 2%, put behind the fact that, you know, we've had this 2% for some time, this 2% is mostly driven by forces that the Fed does not control, right? And they could be very temporary, although I think, you know, insurance premium, medical costs could continue to go up quite a bit, right? But the oil price now is a contribution here, which is the biggie to this 2% is going down. And we're going to see with moderating of a construction for apartments and high-end homes, that's going to weaken. You know, medical costs will probably continue going. And import goods, we don't know what that's going to be. So, you know, this target of 2%, you know, is temporary. It's really extraneous. And it's been going on for some time. So, you know, why now is the Fed saying, oh, we've reached 2%. Now we can raise rates, you know? Could have said that 3 years ago, and you didn't. Because it's just a cover. It's just a cover. Right. The Fed also says, well, you know, Janet Yellen said, oh, well, pretty, it looks like we got some real growth going, right? And you look at the stock market, and the stock market's going up. Oh, must be reflecting real growth coming, right? No, it's reflecting the $6 trillion in business investment tax cuts that are coming and the deregulation, which is already come and coming. Right, and the belief that there will be some infrastructure spending coming. That's what the stock market is based on. Maybes, you know, it's based on a hill of sand here, which may not materialize. Right, may not. We'll have to see. Right, this infrastructure stuff, by the way, we'll talk about some more when it gets a little clearer. But this is going to be this public-private real estate boondoggle, right? And it's not going to create the jobs that he says it is. He, Trump, right? but we'll just have to see. We'll have to see what happens here. The Fed also points to justification, the fact that it's there's been job gains. Oh, we're down to 4.7% unemployment in this country. Well, that's based on the absolute, totally phony U3 unemployment rate, which says there's only 7.5 million people unemployed. Well, that's just permanent, full-time, traditional jobs, you see. Most of them, not most, but much of the economy now increasingly is not permanent full-time jobs. If anything, you know, all those permanent full-time jobs with benefits have been consistently being converted to part-time temp contingent gig jobs. Right? If you, and that's measured by what we call the U6 unemployment rate. Picks up discouraged workers, missing workers, involuntary part-time workers, right? And there's over 15 million of those still in the economy. You know, so twice. It's twice the number of U3. But that's what you hear reported, you know, and that's what the Fed's targeting. Oh, U3, permanent jobs. Well, the whole economy has been restructured. We have over 50 million contingent jobs, you know, a third, about, of the total economy here. And then you add the 7.5 million full-time unemployment. You got like 60 million people unemployed, are part-time temp employed or gig employed or independent contractor employed, no benefits employed, low wages. The studies have showed that 92% of the jobs created in Obama were contingent jobs. Right? So that even the U6 unemployment rate is too low. Why? Because it doesn't include hidden unemployment, as I call it. We should have a U9 unemployment rate, which factors in the fact that we have millions of people who have gone on disability in order to continue unemployment. You know, big surge in disability. All of a sudden, everybody got disabled here since 2008. You know, a couple million, 2 million people on disability, both federal and state, and that really, you know, they're just trying to protect themselves because unemployment benefits are that paltry in this country. So they go on disability, early disability, or they retire, quote, retire at 62, take far less Social Security benefits, you know, because at least it's some money coming in on a regular permanent basis. So this phenomenon of those folks, you know, retiring early, necessarily, but of necessity, I guess, income-wise, and the people going on disability, right? Plus, you got 11 million people undocumented. They're not being accurately picked up by the government because unemployment numbers are based upon phone surveys, you see. And a lot of them are cell phone surveys. You know, undocumented folks aren't going to talk to a government official calling them saying, hey, we want to know if you're working. No, they're not going to do that. So you're not picking those people up. Plus, the underground economy, which used to be estimated at about 8% of GDP, is now double digits. And inner city youth are not being picked up. You know, they're working off the books and so forth. So we should have a U9 unemployment rate. And if we did that, you know, we'd probably have closer to 20 million people still unemployed and an unemployment rate of certainly double digits continuing here after 8 years of the crash. Yeah, so we're not really putting those people back to work. And you can see the weakness in it, the fact of other labor market indicators not being that strong. In other words, the employment population ratio, no change really over the past year or two. The labor force participation rate, no change. Re-entrance, and those people re-entering the labor force is declining. We don't really have this goal. We've reached our job targets. That's BS, too. Right, the inflation is target being reached is BS. The job target being reached is BS. But that's what we hear from the Fed as justification. Well, the real reason why they're raising rates is because the low rates were beginning to destabilize the economy. Not stabilize it, destabilize it. Right? Causing all kinds of problems, you know, including driving companies, you know, into issuing more and more bonds when they didn't need it and raising their debt, which is going to be a long-term problem. right? That's just one of the negative consequences. You know, rates were going negative. Real rates were negative in the U.S. and everywhere else, and even nominal rates were negative in Europe and Japan. So this policy across the advanced capitalist economies is of low interest rates was beginning to cause more problems than it resolved. And therefore, the capitalists, led by the U.S. first, have decided, well, you know, we squeeze that low interest Fed rate lemon as much as we can. You know, it's been great for profits and income for the 1% through various means I discussed. You know, now we're going to need another policy mix. Okay, you know, Trump's got his finger on something here, and yeah, we got to go towards some of these other policies which he's proposing. You see, so there's a real class basis behind what Trump is proposing. A certain wing of the capitalist class in the U.S. says we got to make these moves. We got to move in another direction, different policy mix. Another wing says, no, let's stay the same. You know, we don't need to make these changes, you know, the Hillary wing. What we get is this internecine conflict going on between these two wings of American capital. It's interesting to watch them, isn't it? Fighting it out, you know, just clawing and scratching at each other. And that's going to continue. Because, you know, certain group says, no, we don't want to make these changes. And the other group says, yeah, we got to make these changes. So, you know, they're fighting it out. We'll see who wins here. We'll take a front row seat and, you know, enjoy the show a little bit. Yes, it's enjoyable, isn't it? Yes. Okay, well, no, gee, folks are going to disagree with that. Say, are you crazy? Is this enjoyable? Yeah, I like to see them fight amongst themselves. Yes. Okay. So, you know, all this BS about the Fed, about reaching its targets, is just that. It's just BS. The real shift is coming because low interest rates were destabilizing their system. And now they're trying to move to a new policy mix, right? Well, what are the consequences of this going to be, this shift to a new policy mix? Well, one of the consequences, very clearly, is that it's going to have an influence economically on other central banks doing the same, because, you know, the U.S. central bank is the bank, central bank of the central banks. And the others follow, at least in the advanced economies, they tend to follow. So, you know, what we got going here is, you know, the European Central Bank is wondering whether they should raise interest rates or not. Long-term rates, by the way, are drifting up already in Europe. And now the question is, you know, should the European Central Bank do the same? Well, the European Central Bank, before they raise short-term rates, has to get rid of QE, their QE. But they don't want to, because it looks like Europe is in a big problem here this year, a political instability. And we're going to see very soon here the results of the Dutch election and French elections and then Italian elections and then the German elections. And if the far right, Trump-like far right, prevails increasingly in Europe, it's going to cause political instability, and therefore that will spill over to economic instability, and the ECB, European Central Bank, may not end QE. That's why they're sort of holding out, waiting to see. Right? But the pressure will grow on them to allow interest rates to rise as well, to keep up with the rise in the U.S. rates. Well, that will drive up the value of the euro once they start raising rates, ending QE and raising rates, and driving up the euro will result in interest rate hikes in Europe as well, slow down their economy. Okay, and we got global oil prices. That's going to continue its direction, which means that rates will rise. And the dollar, and Japan, they're going to be the big benefactors of this. And China's watching the whole thing, wondering what it should do. Chinese Central Bank, People's Bank of China. And then the big question is, will the Fed start selling its $4.5 trillion portfolio? If it does, well, that will drive bond prices down and rates even higher. So we'll see what happens with all this interest rate to do here. but it's part of the bigger picture. It should not be viewed independently. Okay, this is Jack.